That's kind of the cliche line that you'll hear a lot of Christian guys say. It's like, well, that's the thing that God's given me to do. It's just raise my kids and raise my family well. And I'm just focused on that. And I'm just going to do my job and take care of my family. And that's it. Well, that doesn't really follow with what it says in, I think it's in 1 Peter, where he talks about, look not only to your own interests, but to the interests of others. We have to make sure that us as big brothers, we're looking out for our, you know, we're looking out for the other guys. We don't just get tunnel vision on whatever we're doing for ourselves and, and our own families. That we look up and expand our vision and recognize these things, but also just, we can't stay silent about it.
All right. Well, welcome back, guys, to I Came With Fire podcast. As you can see, the main boss man is out dealing with a situation tonight, but don't let that worry you. I'm sure all those Ukrainian orphans that he's saving are just about ready to make extract, and they're going to be just fine. But here with us tonight, we've got Matt from the YouTube channel Effective Purpose, and I'm really excited to have this conversation with you, Matt. But before we jump into it, I just kind of want to frame in some of the stuff that we're going to be talking about tonight. Now, you run a channel, and the way that I found you was a video where you were talking about how the modern dating system is broken. And I do believe that you use the phrasing in there, and in fact, it is openly hostile toward men. And that really captured my attention. And so I ended up watching that video and then like several more of your videos. And I was like, dude, I got to get this guy on so that we can talk to you about that. But just to kind of frame in, like the confines of the conversation where we're going tonight, I'd really like to get a chance to talk to you about the structures that are in place that have led to the dating system being broken, the structures that caused what we're seeing, yeah, plus the ones that are perpetuating it, that are keeping it in place. I'd like to kind of talk about some of the incentives behind those structures. Why did they come about in the first place, and why are they being kept? Who stands to benefit from the way the system is set in place right now? And then the propaganda machine that's used to keep all of that going and churning. Because if it's as bad as you describe it in your videos, and I do believe that it is, I'm an older married man now at 35, almost 36. Mm-hmm. And so a lot of the stuff that you're talking about was kind of an ice bath to me. I was like, I didn't know it was this bad. I mean, back when I, got my girlfriend, who met her in youth group and then she eventually became my wife, it was like talk to a girl at youth group, right? Go to church, find a girl at church. I did that whole thing. And then here we are, five kids later, happily married. And the system that you presented to me, I was like, this is alien to me. I didn't know that this was there. So I'd really like to get a chance to unpack all of that with you tonight. The structures, the incentives, and then the propaganda. And then if we can, at the end, the so what? Like, so what are we supposed to do about it, right? Which is the million-dollar question going forward. But exactly. before we're off to the races, Matt, please introduce yourself to our listeners, who you are, what you do, and maybe even, like, why you started the channel Effective Purpose.
Well, yeah, that's a good question right there, the why. I started this channel a few years ago just because I felt like that was just something God wanted me to do. I didn't really understand why at the time. And when I kind of started it off, I was just doing mostly kind of advice-based content. Originally, I had envisioned doing something like just answering people's life questions. I did a brief stint as a Bible college teacher and instructor, and one of the things that I did in that class was I would just have the students bring in their questions from whatever passage or section of scripture we were looking at that particular week, and I just said, hey, like, how does this scripture interact with your life? Like, what questions does this bring up for you as far as like how you do the world, And they had a huge amount of engagement with that. They really loved that, and they would always bring stuff in and have really good conversations with that. And so I was like, well, maybe I could take that into the online sphere and bring that to the channel. And tried that for a little bit and discovered that, first of all, that's not something that like you can just show up and a bunch of people who are strangers on the internet immediately trust you with, which is shocking. I should have anticipated that. But I also discovered that there's a certain hunger for a particular kind of information out there, especially with the guys, which is once you're on YouTube, that's most of who you're dealing with. And the guys that I was starting to interact with, they wanted to know, like, how do I do just this most basic thing of all, which would, I mean, used to be the most basic thing, which is how do I get married? Like, how do I figure out how to get that girlfriend at youth group? Because it just isn't happening. And I, you know, resonated with that because I'm someone who, I didn't get married until I was 36 years old. And it was a massive struggle for me. And, you know, I started to get this sense that, you know, I'm probably not the only guy out there that has that struggle going on, or for whom it was just an unbelievable slog of constantly getting rejected and treated poorly and nobody telling you why. Like the most of the people in the churches that I went to, their only answer was, well, I guess it's just not God's will for you to have a wife yet. Which gets really hard to hear after your 20th year of hearing that, or thereabouts. You know, it gets really old and really tough after a while. And so I was like, you know what? Maybe this is a process issue. And so I started digging into it's kind of what you'd call more manosphere, red pill content, and realizing, you know what? A lot of this stuff these guys are saying, I'm seeing with my own eyes. And so I started to try to take some of that stuff, because a lot of it is like, okay, they're accurately diagnosing what's happening. A lot of the time they've got good descriptions, but a lot of their prescriptions about what to do, well, they're not Christians. And so they're not really telling you how to do it in a way that honors God necessarily. So I was like, well, maybe I can take some of that information that helped me to have a little bit of success with women and actually eventually get married, and just kind of clean it up and present like a Christian version of that stuff. But from there, I started to notice that even that wasn't really resonating with a lot of the guys. What I found is that there was a lot of pushback from guys who were like, yeah, but what about the ladies? Like, why is it always on us to just whatever standards they set, we have to, you know, they say jump, we have to say how high, and it doesn't matter how high it is, we have to try to reach it even if it's not possible for us. And why do they get to get away with whatever kind of behaviors they want, while all the focus is put on us and our behavior and what we need to do better and how we need to grow and what we need to repent of? How come none of that's ever put on them? And so, you know, at first I kind of pushed back against that because I didn't really understand where they were coming from with that. It's like, yeah, I see that, but we're supposed to be men. We're supposed to, you know, be the tough guys that just, you know, we take it on the chin and we keep moving and you know, just tough it out, whatever happens. And so I was, you know, I shifted the content more that direction, trying to, you know, encourage guys to, hey, just suck it up and do it anyway. And here's ways that'll make it easier for you. It wasn't until I started to uncover this kind of thing that you mentioned at the beginning of there is this sort of favoritism that we see in the modern church, where if you're a guy, you are held to high standards and you are held accountable for your behavior. You are told, hey, here's the thing that you need to achieve. Here's the bar that you need to get to. And here's all the things that you're doing wrong that are keeping you from getting there. And not that any of that's bad. Guys need that. And everybody needs that. But, and then if the guys get it wrong, they're held accountable for it, right? If they stumble into sin, we've got programs and apps and accountability, you know, partnership programs and all that stuff to deal with men's behavior. But I started realizing, hold up a second, we don't have anything like that. Like, not even similar for the ladies. Like, there's sometimes like women's groups and things like that where it's just sort of assumed that they'll kind of hold each other accountable, similar to how men usually do. But the stories that I was hearing from, you know, a lot of the girls that I would know who would go to those, and stories that I would hear from my own wife about, you know, the way those groups go, it just became more and more clear. I was like, wait a second, we do not have structures right now that are designed to hold women accountable for their behavior, or call them to something higher, or teach them genuine wisdom about life and how to do things, and set standards for them that they should try to reach as far as their behavior and how they treat men and how they treat each other. It's just sort of assumed that once a woman is a Christian, she's just gonna be a good Christian, and we don't really need to pay much attention after that. And I started thinking through that, going, hold up, it's entirely possible that a lot of this difficulty that guys are experiencing in the dating world, and even after that, once they get married, a lot of guys are reporting that, you know, their wives treat them pretty badly. And I mean, that's to say nothing of like how destructive a divorce is for these guys. Mm-hmm. And it is still, you know, fairly common that that will happen even in Christian communities. And so I was like, well, what if those things are symptoms of sin that we've just allowed to go unaccountable on the ladies' side of the aisle? Like men do all kinds of egregious stuff, we know that, and we try our best to curb that sin and find ways to deal with it and rebuke them and discipline them and teach against it, try to incentivize them to behave better. But we don't really do that for women. What if these things that these guys are reporting are just downstream of that? Like, they're just like, you know, causally downstream of us just kind of stopping the accountability process on the ladies' side. And so I think that's where the conversation for this really starts. And the more I started diving into that on the YouTube channel, the more response I started to get. That was when the guys started to say, yes, this matches what I'm seeing. You know, it went from this sort of like, hold up, why are you always talking about what we need to do? This doesn't make any sense, to, oh, I get it. Like, yes, there's something broken here. So yeah, that's kind of the 30,000 foot overview of like how I landed, where I landed, with this particular, this moment in, you know, in this particular channel.
So. Nice. Well, let's go back to the beginning then and talk about the structures in place that got us to here where we are, like you described, that the ladies are getting let off the hook, or there's not even a hook. The dudes are just getting hammered constantly. Like, how did we get here, right? Like, what's the structure that led to this?
Well, there's this Thomas Sowell quote that I really like, where he says, he's talking about economics, but this is true of all of our culture, where he says, we've spent the last like 50, 70, 80 years or something like that, replacing what works with what feels good. And I think that that's really at the heart of what led to a lot of these issues, is we started to, you could say what you want about the secular world. It's always going to have its problems. It's not guided by the Holy Spirit. They're not following God's way. They're going to have all kinds of, you know, sin and destruction in their lives. And you can expect that. It's when you start to see churches having similar problems inside their own doors, that's kind of the canary in the coal mine that says, oh, wait, shoot, something that's going on out there has infiltrated and made its way in here, inside of our doors. And I think what happened was, I mean, the sort of cliche answer that everybody's throwing around out there right now is feminism. I think there's more of what you're seeing right now isn't just feminism, it's more of a romanticism. You still have in most churches male leadership. It's guys in charge. It's guys are the ones, you know, pushing the messages that the churches put out there. It's the guys enforcing the discipline. You know, they're the ones who are teaching and putting out rebukes, and they're deciding what needs to get talked about and how to talk about it. So this isn't something that like feminist women are actively pushing for and doing themselves so much as it's something that the male leadership has allowed to infiltrate their thinking and their practice. Where, and I think when we talk about how did we get here, I think it started with that. I think a lot of the guys felt like they were in some sense protecting women. If they were to, like, if you're just a pastor, and you see that somebody is saying, hey, this woman behaved in a way that was not good. You know, she was, you know, being disrespectful to her husband or something like that. And you see this even now. I just released a couple of videos talking about how there are Christian influencers doing this today. You'll see guys swoop in and say, well, hold up. No, we can't call her out for that. We don't want to talk about that, because that might endanger her somehow. What you see is guys genuinely believe that they are protecting women by shielding them from accountability, because we can speculate all day about like why that is. Maybe they see that my sort of like semi-autistic engineer brain like connects the dots back to just they think that, well, it's an intuition. It's an intuition where they believe that because, okay, actually no, let's back up. So if a woman is in danger, right, that activates some instincts in us as guys, right? And that's a very natural thing. And we all have that instinct to be that sort of hero that protects the woman, be the knight in shining armor that saves what John Eldridge calls the golden haired woman. That's like the story that's written on our hearts. Mm-hmm. And for most of human history, that story was not super difficult to fulfill because there were lots and lots of very real dangers out there. And I mean, there's lions, bandits, you know, there's a harsh winter coming every 6 months or 9 months or whatever. And so there's all kinds of real world things that you need to protect women from. But in our world today, a lot of those aren't really threats anymore. Like, you don't have to protect women from the elements. You don't have to protect them from predators and roving bandits so much of the time. But we still have that instinct to protect women from something. We have that story that wants to be satisfied, that says, I need to protect women some way in order for me to feel like a valid man. And so whenever, as things get safer, men just sort of default down to whatever looks like the most threatening thing. So if it looks to a man like the most threatening thing is somebody is saying something that stains this woman's reputation, they'll protect her from that stain. And so they'll, if someone comes in with an accusation and says, hey, this woman wasn't behaving well, or women in general, like I'm seeing this pattern where women will behave in this particular way that's maybe, you know, kind of self-centered, like as soon as you bring up something like hypergamy, and how even Christian women only want like the top, like maybe 5% of guys that walk through the doors of their church, everybody will get up in arms and they'll start defending those women because that sounds like you're attacking their character. It sounds like you're slandering them in some way, or you're staining their reputation. And so you have a bunch of guys who they want to satisfy that hero instinct in themselves. And so they go into defense mode and they start defending women from any type of accusation of sin in order to protect your reputation. Now, it's super damaging for those women a lot of the time because sin destroys everything. It destroys her first, and then it destroys the people around them. So it's not actually protecting women. But I think that is sort of the base building block that got us to where we are, is we started accepting a lot of we started accepting whatever it is that women say that they want us to do and just going along with it. If they say that they don't want any standards set on them, okay, cool, we'll do that because that makes us feel like a hero. They say that they want to have more power and more leverage, then we'll do that because that makes us feel like a hero. So yeah, I think when we're talking about incentives, it comes down at that most fundamental level to the emotional incentives.
Do you think it's fair to say that we've allowed feminism to infect the church?
That is, yeah. I mean, that is kind of my thesis. Is we did it because of romanticism, and it makes us feel like heroes as men. But yeah, it is the core tenets of feminism, which is, I mean, you'll see this all the time. I've talked about this over on my channel quite a bit, is the feminist power narrative, which is that idea. It's this core Marxist idea that everything is a power struggle, and that in order for a person to be valuable, safe, and to be happy, they have to have power and control. And so if a woman is captured by that story, then you cannot challenge her autonomy. Like, you cannot challenge her ability to control herself and make all of her own decisions and usually make all the decisions for the people, you know, that she's close with, whether it's her husband or her children or whatever. Because in her mind, that's the feminist story is telling her, I need to have this power. I need to be in control. Otherwise, if men have more control over this situation than I do, then I'm worth less than they are. Now, I think that's a totally false story. That's not actually what's going on. There's nothing in scripture that I can tell that says that people need to have power in order to be worth something or even to be valuable to God or to even to be happy. That doesn't appear to be true. I mean, there does appear to be a sort of clear hierarchical structure that everyone is under some kind of leadership. Like, even if you're a man, you're under the leadership of, you know, at the people that you work for. You're under the leadership of your church eldership and your leaders at your church. You're under the leadership of God himself. You know, so everybody has to submit to somebody. And so I don't see that that's a true narrative, but I think that that sort of feminist power narrative especially has worked its way into our churches.
Yeah, it almost seems like in a way where it's like a fish doesn't know it's wet. In modern society, it's hard to even point at something and recognize the behind the curtain.
To
a thing like feminism, to recognize that behind the curtain, because it's like it almost feels like in a way it's like, well, this is just the way things are.
Yeah.
And perspective is always good in situations like this, because you would go, well, this isn't the way it's always been.
Mm-hmm.
Right? But to our understanding of the world and our paradigm now in the current timeline, it's like, oh, but this is the way things are.
Yeah.
It is hard, because what you're talking about and pushing back on some of these things is actual fundamental societal change.
Yeah.
In a power structure. I mean, you said it yourself, right? Like, you know, the idea that power is what makes you valuable. And I think I actually heard it on your channel, and I took it and I put it in my pocket, because I was like, that's good. The dynamic in a marriage, equal in value, but mm-hmm. not necessarily in power. Like, because somebody has to be in authority, right?
Yeah.
But like, the, you know, according to the biblical structure, you know, and it should come as no surprise to anybody on this channel that I am a Christian. It's just we don't talk about Christian values that often, or the Bible that often. But, you know, the man is supposed to be the head of the household, and the wife is supposed to submit. And usually it's funny, anytime you sit in a church service and that type of stuff comes up, power dynamics in a marriage, you can feel the room bristle.
Yeah.
Ooh.
Yeah.
You
and
know,
you're activating that story. Like, because it's not just, you know, the woman in that situation. Everybody has that story sort of baked into their perspective, where when you say, hey, a man should have like headship or authority over his household and even over his wife, they don't hear you saying those words. That's not what came out of your mouth as far as they're concerned. What they just heard you say is that women can't be as happy as men. They heard you say that women can't be as valuable as men. They can't be as prosperous as men. They can't have as high a quality of life as men. Because to them, power and control are equal to all those things. It's a one-to-one ratio. However much you have of those things is how much value and happiness you'll have as a person. So they hear you saying that woman is worth less. And again, that's why I push back so hard against that story, because it is not true. But you almost kind of can't have a conversation about this with people until you first address that narrative, because people bristle.
Yeah. So that's how we got to where we are. What are the structures that are keeping this in place, like in the modern scene? And feel free to, like, we can go into talking about the swipe right online dating sphere, like feel free to just all of it. But I know you're coming at it from the church side of things, and I really appreciate that, because I think that's a thing that people are going to be like, whoa, 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 now you're saying it's in the church too. You're saying, and don't let me put words in your mouth, it's especially in the church. Not just as it wormed its way into the church, like, it's especially in the church, right?
Yeah. Well, and the reason, I don't know that I can say with numbers that it's any worse in the church, but I can say from my experience, a lot of the guys that I talk to, guys that I've coached, that it can be worse because for a lot of Christian women, they don't just have one list of stuff that they want from you as a man. They have two lists. So, excuse me. With a, I actually, when I was dating, I had an easier time getting non-Christian girls to go out with me than I did Christian girls. And a lot of them would very quickly, you know, want to move things forward with me. Whereas, the Christian girls were the ones who were a lot more hesitant. And a lot of that has to do with, Christian women have the same list of worldly standards, which is they want you to be tall, handsome, successful, charismatic, and, you know, have, all the right kind of social ties and all of that stuff. They have the same list of stuff that they want, and you have to have enough stuff checked off on that list before they'll consider you at all for the second list, which is your spiritual worthiness. You have to be the guy that's, you know, front and center in some kind of ministry at your church, and you know, you've got to be doing enough of the Bible studies and this and that and the other thing. And a lot of times it's tougher with the really churchy church girls, because they have both of those lists, and they both have higher standards on those lists than a lot of secular women do, because it seems like many of them believe that their own faith practice makes them deserve an even higher quality of man than a secular woman might. There almost seems to be this mindset that, well, because I'm this high quality Christian woman who, you know, I took notes during the sermon my whole life, and I, you know, raised my hands during the worship and all of that, and I went to all the Bible studies, that means I deserve only the best of the best of the best. So there can, with a lot of Christian women, there can be an even higher set of standards for them. And it's not immediately obvious to me that these women really offer men that much more than a secular woman does, in order to justify all of that extra set of hoops that men have to jump through and the level that they have to reach. And I think I've told this story on my channel before, but there was this one girl that I very briefly went out with, who very Christian, but she was also very much career oriented, and she was all about her PhD studies and publishing papers and all of that kind of stuff. She didn't want to have kids. Did not want to be a helper, sort of how the Bible describes, at all. That was not, she had no interest in that. It was kind of unclear what she did want in a marriage. It was more like she just wanted somebody to be her, sort of long-term friend with benefits, whenever it suited her. And that was, that wasn't, it wasn't like every Christian girl that I dated was like that, but I've met a number who they will pass up really good opportunities with really good men because, I got to focus on my career, I got to focus on this thing, and they don't really want to offer men very much of anything that would make a man want to do all of the work that it takes to get together with them. That's one of the toughest hurdles for guys to overcome, just on the standards side. And it's making a lot of guys look at it and go, I don't know if this is worth it at all. What am I doing here? How is this helping anyone? How would that even be a productive wife to marry, even if I could marry her? So I think that's structure number one. I'd have to,
Can you unpack hypergamy for us? Because you mentioned it earlier, and just from watching through your content, to me, I'm like, I think that if people understood this, and it, as it pertains to the structures in place, then I think a lot of the other things that you're talking about become clear to, I can, again, structure, but it's like now, yeah, I can put it in a box and understand what I'm looking at.
Well, with hypergamy, I think it's more important just to go down, drill down to bedrock on what the instincts are that are driving it. And because just about everything that people do in general is driven by incentives, kind of like you mentioned. And if people aren't really held accountable to any standards of any kind, and they're just sort of allowed to, you know, just they're just sort of left to their own devices, they're going to default down to just doing what feels right. And a lot of times those feelings are governed by instincts and just base level biological drives, whether we recognize it that way or not. And I know especially with Christians, that's kind of a taboo topic. We don't like that idea of instinct. Even though we know it's a thing and we can see it and it's very definitely real, a lot of times we go, oh, well, the Bible doesn't really talk about that, sort of. So it can't be real because, you know, everything is in the Bible, even though that's not really how the Bible works. But if we could, and that is another structure, I think, that's kind of holding things back, is it's really difficult just to have these conversations because there's so much of that, like, Christianese culture that says, well, it doesn't really matter what the data says or what the observational evidence says because it doesn't match what I think the Bible says. And so, like, as soon as you bring up something like hypergamy, it becomes really contentious and, you know, people go, whoa, I don't like the way that that sounds, because hypergamy is essentially just women looking out for themselves. It's they're attempting to get the absolute best possible source of resources that they possibly can. For if, I mean, because if you just put yourself in a woman's shoes, especially if you're someone who, you're a woman who does want to have kids at some point, or you, whether you acknowledge it or not, maybe you just feel that biological urge to have kids. There's also going to be a part of you that knows that once you do, you're going to be vulnerable. You're not going to be able to protect yourself from threats quite as much. You're not going to be able to go out and secure resources for yourself quite the same way. And, you know, women are already starting off living in the weaker vessel, so to speak. So they're already kind of at in a hard place when it comes to securing resources and defending themselves to begin with. And so in order for a woman to survive, I mean, at least if you rewind back before the modern era where things are, you know, a lot safer, a lot more sanitized, for most of human history, if you're a woman, you kind of have to outsource a lot of your protection and provision to a man. That's going to be somewhere in your instincts is, okay, I need to get a man who can bring in resources and a man who can shield me from all of the dangers and threats in the world. Now, the quality there matters too, because if she's not going to be doing it herself, she's not in direct control of how safe she becomes and how secure and provided for she becomes. That's going to be the man. And in a high danger world, a high consequence world, like the one that we had for most of human existence, the better the man that you're with, the better your chance of survival, right? If you get a better man, if you get a more successful man, a man who has more intelligence, he's better connected with the community, whatever it may be, and he's a generous man who's willing to share whatever he is able to acquire with you, those traits, well, yeah, if you get a man with those traits, well, yeah, you're gonna be more likely to survive a bandit attack. Because, you know, if he's socially connected, he can go rally his friends to help protect you. You're going to be more likely to survive a harsh winter because he's going to be able to bring in more resources you can store together. So it makes sense. It stands to reason that, yeah, women are going to have instincts to look for markers that men are going to have that kind of success, that they're going to be able to protect and provide in those ways. And when they don't really have anything restraining them, yeah, women are going to default to those instincts, and that's going to be what drives their attraction most of the time. And so what we're seeing today, the reason why hypergamy has become such a discussion today is that for most of human history, there were a lot of things restraining it and making it so that, well, women, yeah, she might feel the desire to get it, the highest quality man she can, but that doesn't mean she necessarily has the ability to, or the options around her. You know, for most of, this probably isn't true, but I heard this stat that, like, the average person today drives past more people on their way to work than a medieval person would have met in their entire life. So, and I mean, sounds right. So obvious, and it was on the internet. So obviously it's true.
Yeah.
But today you have things like you mentioned, social media and dating apps, where it's just exploded the amount of options that women have right up in front of them. You know, they can just pull it up and put it in front of their face. And they have these major tech companies trying to hack their brains to get their attention, to harvest them as an advertising resource, as a data resource. And they do that by hacking into that wiring that women have to try to get the best for themselves and to feel anxious if they don't have the best. And so that's created this situation where it's just sort of exploded that hypergamous instinct. It's not being restrained by like, well, there's only like 15 guys in my township, I'm gonna have to pick one of them, or maybe my parents are gonna have to pick one of them, or whatever it is, versus now, no, I've literally got access to all 5 million guys in the state that I live in if I want to, and they're being fed to me algorithmically, so I'm only really seeing the top of the top anyway. So, and you know, I'm seeing on my social media feed, you know, Janet and Sharon and all of these girls in my friend group who are, you know, hanging out with these high level men on a boat somewhere, and I don't want to be left behind in that. So there's this like social pressure and all of that to follow those instincts and to get the best they can. And yeah, nobody's really, especially in the Christian space, because it's a taboo topic and you're not really allowed to be honest about it, because it, you know, sounds bad to say that women behave that way. That has just allowed that instinct to run the show and just go unchecked. And now we're seeing that, yeah, there's that those sort of instincts are driving the ship at this point, because nobody's really pushing back against them.
If you go back to like the 1960s, right, which I think I have this theory about World War II being like a singularity in world history, because kind of the modern era that we accept, like World War II, is that kind of pin in the timeline that our modern world is built on, mm-hmm. you know, both geographically, sociologically, and every other way, economically. But it's like from probably like the 1960s, that generation that matured right after World War II, until now, you kind of see, I would say, like things are mostly stable. Right, by young people going to church, like the type of variation, you'll see it, you know, over decades, but you don't really start seeing the numbers go absolutely wonky really until like right after 9/11 till kind of now, like really the last what, like 25-30 years, and all of a sudden it's just gone, things are just haywire, right, to obviously us millennials, like you're talking about our lifetime, and now we're adults and we're running the show. What do you think, why the reason I brought up the 60s is actually because Summer of Love, right, like you have an explosion of all of this, I guess these kind of undercurrents of society burst up onto the surface with like the hippie movement and free love and drug use and like kind of all this stuff that was kind of maintained underneath for a long time, all of a sudden explode to the surface. And yet through the 70s, it still seemed to kind of stabilize. And you see these things like we were talking about, like hypergamy still really wasn't able to affect things maybe as much as it is now. Do you have a theory as to why, even though there was like, again, so much debauchery, I'm going to call it, that was just like all of a sudden exploded out into the open, and yet still things kind of were relatively stabilized, but then now debauchery out into the open, I mean the trans movement and LGBTQ mm-hmm. this and that and drag queen story out and all the stuff that we're seeing, that's just like, this is insane. And then now all of a sudden the numbers go crazy and people aren't getting married and nothing can happen. Can you rectify those two things, do you think?
Well, I think there's a couple of things. There's a few things going on there. One is you can trace this back to, if you want, to the introduction of no-fault divorce laws. Mm-hmm. And I think it was the early 70s. I think it was Ronald Reagan who was the first one to pass no-fault divorce laws over in California. And you see from that period on, divorce rates absolutely just skyrocketed, and you know, they reached upwards of they reached critical mass pretty quickly. Like within a decade, they were a decade or two, they were up at around 50%. And you think about like the people who are in the dating pool and in churches and stuff like that, during that this last 25 years that you're talking about, well, when were they born? They were born right around that time when divorce rates started to skyrocket. So what we're seeing is a lot of people who were raised in broken homes and raised without direction. A lot of them were raised without fathers around, because once that divorce, once those divorces started to happen, the state was also pretty happy to take those kids away from the men, because it was assumed that men weren't as good at raising kids, even though there's really no evidence to support that. There's actually some pretty strong evidence that it's that's actually backwards, especially once a kid is past their first 2 to 3 years. If they live with their father in a single father environment, their outcomes are miles better, in everything from school to mental health to suicide rates to juvenile delinquency and things like that. Their outcomes are far better if they're with a single father than a single mother. But the state didn't really want to hear that, and it still does not want to hear that. And so we have laws that say, no, it's just, what do they say? They say women have a right to their kids, men have to fight for their kids. And that's just, those are the kids that are now coming of age in this particular era, is a bunch of kids who are lost, and they come from a place of brokenness to start with. And they never really had solid masculine influences in their life. So yeah, it makes sense that they would be rebelling against the idea of masculinity in general. Or they would be overreacting, going the other direction to, you know, sort of the more hyper, you could say just like far hyper right, where it's this sort of hyper masculine. It's more about the aesthetic of masculinity, and, you know, that sort of gruff, callous, the vision of what people think masculinity is. They gravitate towards that, looking for something. And so, yeah, I think there's a lot of brokenness in the world that has, or in our particular culture, that's come about because of that. If you look at the correlations with the dating collapse in particular, though, it really does center around social media and dating apps, and at the same time, the sort of breakdown of the economy that has come along with the sort of the 2008 crash, that we've been sort of living in this weird, I don't know, some people have called it, you know, just this massive wealth transfer, where it, because we started right around that time, we started printing a ton of money to make sure that the banks didn't fail, to make sure that all the programs, the government programs that older generations voted into place for themselves didn't fail. You know, none of the stuff that the sort of post-World War II generation voted in, none of the stuff that they voted in for themselves could ever be put in jeopardy, because they're the biggest voting block. And so, you know, our leaders and politicians want to get reelected, so they're going to cater to the biggest demographic. And so, yeah, we've been voting for bailouts for everything, and now we're paying the bill for that, because all of those bailouts and all of those government programs, those aren't free. They're just long-term loans. And now we're seeing that those generations, well, yeah, now it's their kids that are having to pay the bill through inflation. And as things inflate, well, the older generations who aren't working, they're not reliant on labor anymore. They're relying on capital. And with inflation, capital becomes worth more. Wages and labor becomes worth less. So that makes it really tough for you as a younger person just to get started out at all and become economically viable. If you're a man trying to attract a woman, well, thing number one is you got to become economically viable. And it's really hard to do that in an environment that's just inflating so fast that the bus is driving away faster than you can catch up. And so that, and then you have this compound effect where women are seeing, they feel like they need to get the best possible man. They see that the world is going crazy around them, and so they want the security of the hyper high value, high level man. But at the same time, we see this increasing disparity in the economy between especially the young and the old, where if you're a young person, it's incredibly difficult to meet that standard. And so that has kind of just driven this wedge in where you now see all this frustration and, you know, guys are sort of giving up on it because it looks insurmountable. It looks like the rewards that they get for actually, you know, attracting a woman aren't really worth it anymore. And then you see the ladies complaining because they're like, where have all the good men gone and all of that stuff. And so, yeah, I think there's a few different factors you can trace it back to that have kind of created this perfect storm that has kind of hit all at the same time. And then you had like the COVID shutdowns. And I think that was really the thing that shut the door for a lot of guys. Because before that, like, you dating apps and online dating were a thing, but there was kind of a stigma around them. You know, if you were dating, like if you were online dating before that, girls that you met there would sort of be like, oh, why are you here? Why are you online? Why didn't you meet somebody in real life? Like, they would be questioning you about it. But once the COVID lockdowns happened, that was the only way to meet people. And that sort of completely legitimized it. That made it the norm and the standard. And that just slammed the door on any chances guys have of meeting women in real life and having a shot with them that way. And yeah, getting to the top of those algorithms is way tougher than impressing a girl in real life. So yeah, it's just all of that stuff kind of hit at the same time.
Yeah, I think we've pretty much hammered on all the structures being hypergamy, no-fault divorce laws, right? Feminism in general.
Yeah.
And kind of the incentives of why seem to unpack themselves as we went. But I'm really interested, if we know that this is bad, dudes are lonelier than they've ever been, right? Women aren't seeming to be happy. Like you just said, where have all the good guys gone, right? So they got seemingly everything they asked for and now are realizing that they're not happy with what they chose.
Yeah.
I guess my biggest question is, what are the incentives of keeping these structures in place? Like, who stands to benefit from this at this point if all of the end users are being left behind and trampled, right?
Well, yeah, I don't think that we're quite there yet to where like all of the end users are losing. The people that you see who still are in church, like it's the you know, standard issue married couple with a couple of kids, those people are actually still doing really well for themselves. Yeah, like guys like you and me,
right?
We're actually doing pretty well for ourselves most of the time. As long as you manage to avoid the minefield of divorce and the reviling wife, as Dr. Edgington puts it, which are like, yeah, you're the chances of running into that kind of problem are going up and up and up. But as long as you avoid that stuff, it's the you know, sort of married trad con life is actually still pretty good. And so what if you're one of those trad con guys, well, you have a pretty heavy incentive to keep the status quo going the way that it is. And I understand why. I mean, this is why you'll see a lot of the sort of like daily wireists, as I call them, like your Michael Knowles and Ben Shapiro and those types of guys. They aren't really super interested in talking about any of these structures or the problems with them. They just want men to keep going into the meat grinder and just keep trying and trying and trying, because they accurately recognize that if guys stop, this whole thing falls apart. Like, if men don't participate in society, we're done. Because I think it is true to say that the family unit is the foundational unit of a stable society. We see that history, I mean, as long as the family structure is stable, a culture has a shot at being stable. Once you start tinkering and messing with that, cultures break down pretty quickly, not long after. So yeah, I think that they're right in their assessment that, yeah, we got to get guys back in here, get them going again, because if they don't, yeah, this whole thing is going to implode. And it's not just going to implode on us, it's going to implode on our kids too. And that's something that, like, if you're a parent, like, you know, you do not want to send your kids out into a world that was even worse than the one that you grew up in. And yeah, you don't want them to have to deal with these minefields and things like that. So I mean, to them, I understand why they would have a sort of emotional incentive to either pretend that these problems aren't real or that they aren't that bad. And, you know, it's just, come on, guys, it's not really happening that much. And if you just come into church, you won't experience those problems that are out there in the secular world and all of that. Because if that's the case, well, then, yeah, and you know, nothing really is wrong for us. Then, and it's just a propaganda and a narrative issue. Well, then, yeah, I can understand the place that they arrive at, which is, well, we just got to put out better propaganda. Get these guys believing that there are no problems, get them trying again, get them, you know, going through the process, getting married and having kids and having families again. But yeah, that doesn't seem to be matching what's happening for a lot of these guys. It's not really working for a lot of them. And they are getting stuck on the outside. But yeah, I can understand the incentive structure to keep the status quo going kind of the way that it is, especially for the guys on the inside. It's just that number of guys on the inside is shrinking. It used to be the majority. Like back in the 90s, back when we were kids, it was still something like 80 or 90% of men or somewhere around in there were in some kind of long-term relationship, if not married. So there was, but at that time, most guys were kind of, you know, getting into the club, so to speak. But that number has shrunk way down. It's something like only, it's at this point, I think for men 18 to 29, it's less than a third are in a long-term relationship. And that's not even counting marriages. I would have to go back and double check that stat, but yeah, if I remember reading, yeah, there's an article I saw where it said that, about a little over 60% of men in that age range are not romantically connected to a woman at all, and half of those single guys are not looking. They've just sort of stopped looking. So what we're seeing is that it's actually the minority of guys that are making it into that sort of, you know, Christianese good life club. So that's why we're seeing this kind of tension between these two factions start to heat up, because it used to be that, you know, a guy that didn't get married or was stuck on the outside, he was kind of an outlier, and it was easy to kind of brush that off as being like, you know, there must be something wrong with him. Something's going on with him. And so we don't really need to think about it. But now it's becoming a majority of men, to the point that it's like, look, we can't brush this aside anymore. We got to start looking at what's going on here.
I mean, it's terrifying, right? Because if dudes aren't getting married, if you don't have a wife, if you don't have kids, like, what do you have to fight for?
Yeah.
Right? Like, it's absolutely crucial, and you already brought it up. You know, the family unit is the bedrock of society. Where, if these young men, if such a large cohort of them are opting out entirely and not looking, where are they and what are they doing? Where are their pursuits right now?
Right now, they're not doing very much. I think about 1 in 7 men in the West are what they call NEETs, not in employment or education or training. So they're literally doing nothing. And yeah, I think a lot of guys, their pursuit is just video games and survival. It's just, they have a, like, I have a fair amount of these guys who will comment on my videos on my channel, and they'll share their perspectives, and sometimes, you know, they'll send me emails and things like that, and it is sad, like, to watch it happen. But these guys are genuinely doing what they feel like is the best that they can do, which is just to stay away. Like, the whole, like, that whole idea of trying to find a wife and get married, it looks too dangerous, and it looks like it's not rewarding, it's not profitable, you know, at least not to the level of effort, sacrifice, and risk and all of that you have to take on. So to them, it looks like the best possible thing they can do is just kind of pull the covers over and hope that, you know, this whole thing blows over. There's even this thing that I'm starting to see more often. It's called accelerationism, where guys actually want the world to collapse. There's a really, really popular, like, political streamer out there right now. His name is Asmongold. I think he might actually be the top political streamer at the moment. He actually is an accelerationist. Like, he will openly say, yeah, if these people that we're voting for aren't actually going to accomplish anything, and these people we're putting into positions of leadership, they're not prosecuting bad actors, they're not making changes, they're not fixing anything, well, then yeah, just let it all burn, let it all break. Because that's the only, like, there's a, the way a lot of guys are looking at it is things are so broken right now that I do not have a shot with the current system as it is. So I'm either going to sort of sit on the sideline and wait for it to collapse, or I'm actively going to try to accelerate it and push it along and hope that it collapses sooner. Because in their mind, the only possible way that they'll have a shot is, you know, after you sort of flip the playing board over and everything gets rearranged and you start playing a whole new game. It's like, well, it's like I didn't have any shot before. I don't know after all of that chaos if I'll even survive or what kind of shot I'll have after that. But my chances can't be any worse than they are now. So I'm just going to, you know, I'm going to wait for after the collapse because my chances might be better after that. So, yeah, you're seeing guys who they're either just opting out, they're, you know, hiding in things like video games and you know, they, yeah, it's a really kind of lonely existence where they don't really have, I like a decent number of guys that I've coached, they don't really have any friends in real life even. They don't really go out of whatever place they live except to do their job. And so that's kind of how they see it. It's like, I'm just going to go to work, come home, you know, try to numb the whatever it is, you know, the depression or whatever it is I'm feeling with video games or whatever I can, and just wait for this life to be over and done with.
That is a depressing note. We can't stay there.
No, we absolutely can't.
Okay, so I think we've done a pretty good job of like painting the canvas about the situation in its fullness and like how bleak it really is. What's the propaganda machine that's keeping this going, that's convincing people that the incentives are still worth it, those guys that you talked about? Like, in fact, let me narrow this in just a little bit, right? Because you did talk about the fact that it's the dudes that have kind of let's call it, you know, crossed the finish line of marriage, in that they navigated the battlefield, they wooed said strumpet, they walked her down the aisle, and now, hey, like, I'm onto this side of the playing field now. Like, that, those are the guys that you said have the most amount of incentive, and ladies that have, they have the most amount of incentive to keep the structure in place. What is the propaganda machine that's being utilized in order to do that? It sounds like, from what you said earlier, you alluded to, like, a lot of it's coming from the right. From, well, let's not say the right, let's say from a traditional base, because we are talking about marriage, right? We're not talking about the homosexual community. We're not talking about alternative lifestyles. We're talking about traditional marriage, you know, as Christianity of the Bible would prescribe it, right? So is that fair to say? Like, yeah, that's where we've kind of maintained this conversation.
Yeah.
So it sounds like a lot of that propaganda is coming from the traditionalists, right?
Mm-hmm.
So how is that being implemented? Does that question make sense? Like, if you have one group and it's a shrinking and minority group that is okay with the status quo, but a growing group that is becoming disillusioned and, like you said, accelerating into ready for the collapse, how is this propaganda being spun? Like, or is it even being received? Is it just not anymore? I guess that would be a good place to start.
Maybe. Well, yeah, this is something that I'm still kind of in the process of diagnosing and trying to figure out, like, the workings of this. And I don't know, there's all kinds of rumors and speculation that I've heard from people that I've come in contact with about how there might be some behind the scenes money involved with some of the larger content creators in the sort of traditionalist space. To try to push certain narratives. I've heard stories about how, I mean, this is this is just speculation as far as I'm concerned, but you know, I've heard people say stuff like, the reason why the Daily Wireists, like your Matt Walsh and Michael Knowles and all those guys, were attacking things like the Red Pill was because they got orders from their higher ups at the Daily Wire that, hey, this thing, we've decided this thing is bad, kill it. And it's like, I don't really have any actual insider information that confirm that or give any reason or insight as to why they would do it. But that does seem to be where most of that sort of, I guess, if you know, you could call it propaganda. That's where it's coming from. There are also a number of sort of apologia content creators in kind of the Christian sphere who are perpetuating that kind of these kind of same things, where it's like they don't want you to talk about these problems. They don't want you to acknowledge that there's anything negative going on inside the traditionalist camp or inside the Christian camp. And it kind of makes sense why. There's almost this sense that we want to speak something into existence. We want to say that a revival is happening, you know, so that people feel like, oh, that's what's, you know, I want to join up with the wave of what's popular and all of that. And, you know, there's this idea that maybe we can, you know, kickstart something by, you know, drawing people in that way. And there's a similar thing with this sort of like, you'll see articles and things like that about, I saw this Fox News article where they were saying that marriage rates went up by 1% last year, and they zoomed way in on the on the graph to where it looked like it just was, it went down a little bit and then it went up. But if you actually look at the real graph and you zoom out, you see that it's like, and then at the very bottom, it's just boop, just 1% up. And it's like, it's nowhere near enough to show a trend, but they're like hyping it up. Like, yes, people are getting married again, you know, cause it's like, they're almost trying to speak it into existence just by, you know, making people feel like, oh, this is popular. This is what other people are doing. And so I want to be on, and you know, I want to be on the winning team and all of that. I think what's behind most of that sort of propaganda machine is just the tribes. Is we're in a very tribal period of time right now. Whether it's tradcons versus the left or Christians versus atheists and all of that, there's this sense that we're in kind of like a war zone time, where like in years past and decades past, if people disagreed with each other, they'd be like, okay, you know what, you're conservative, I'm a liberal, we see things differently, but we can still eat at the same table. Now it's like, and also we can acknowledge that there's some things that people in our camps say that we disagree with, or that we can acknowledge that our camp doesn't get everything perfect, but we don't see that anymore. We see that there's this total unwillingness to acknowledge that anybody on my team ever makes a mistake or ever says anything that's incorrect or has ever, you know, spun any kind of propaganda or anything like that. That's all out there. That's on the other side with the other team. They are the bad guys. All of the bad, you know, it's the John Cleese video that went viral a little while ago. You know, all like extremism is great because it gives you enemies. That way you can believe that all of the badness in the whole world is out there with them, and all of the goodness in the whole world is over here with you. And yeah, so I think what you're seeing is a couple of tribes that want to maintain that narrative that their tribe is the correct one, the one that's on the right side of history and is getting everything right, and all of the goodness in the world is over here with us, and all the people in the other tribe are getting everything wrong. And anybody that comes along and says, well, hold up, wait a second, no, we've got some stuff we need to look at in our machinery too, so that we can actually be above reproach when we're, you know, we need to take the log out of our own eye before we, you know, look at the speck in our neighbors. There's a lot of people that are like, no, that's, you're not on our team anymore. You know, you're not playing by our team's rules. You're not looking out for our tribe anymore. So yeah, it seems to be that a lot of it is perpetuated by the sort of tribalist mindset and a need to defend the tribe.
Yeah, I think that's very prescient. And then also just, you know, coming from a medical background, right? It's like if the organism is sick, not recognizing that there is a disease inside, and just, you know, I go through this with teammates constantly. You know, and it's like, why are you just bringing this to me now? Well, I thought if I ignored it, it would go away.
Yeah.
Well, it didn't, and now it's 10 times worse. So
yeah, you know, no, that's something that. Yeah, I come from not a medical background, but my dad owns an auto repair shop, and he's like one of the best diagnostic technicians in the Pacific Northwest. Like, other shops send broken cars to him to figure out how to fix. Like, he's that good. But a lot of it comes down to his diagnostic process, which is just, it's, you know, it's the quintessential root cause analysis of just like, hey, just gonna treat this like an engineer. He's a mechanical engineer, and like, you know, he had a shot to go work, you know, high up at Boeing, and was like, ah, it's kind of a cult, I'm not going to do that, and decided to be a mechanic instead. And but he's still like super brilliant and has this, like, he invented or like tweaked and perfected this sort of like diagnostic process that just works, where you just, you, he has this logic tree that he follows, where you just sort of analyze what you're seeing, you analyze the data, and you look back through all of the potential, the tree of, you know, potential causes for what's going on, and you go back to the earliest point that you can get to. You see, you know, if you find something that's out of order or out of alignment, you fix that thing and you retest. And then if something else pops up, well, then you fix that thing and then you retest again. And so that's kind of the mindset that I would bring to this whole thing, is that sort of diagnostic engineer process. But unfortunately, that once you start applying those types of like just logic-based engineer brain diagnostic processes to the things, then you start uncovering stuff that, well, the problems don't really care what team you're on. They don't care what tribe you subscribe to. If there's a problem, it doesn't wear a jersey. Like, it doesn't care what team you're playing for. And so the moment you start opening yourself up to true diagnostic process like that, you open yourself up for criticism, and you open yourself up to have to acknowledge that your tribe isn't necessarily getting things as right as you want to believe. And yeah, I don't think that viewpoint is super welcome right now, but it's like, hey, it's kind of what's needed. So
yeah, but if you keep doing what you've always done, you're going to keep getting what you've always got.
Yeah,
right. That's a perfect jumping off point. So let's apply your diagnostic process. Like, what's the young man to do? Like, what do we do going forward?
Well, step one is, you can't do this alone. There's absolutely no shot that any of this will get fixed if guys just sort of isolate and stay alone, and kind of wait for things to blow over. I tend to agree with the tradcons that, yeah, if guys just sort of hang back out of society, it's going to collapse. And I don't think that there's as high a chance that things are going to be better on the other side of an absolutely terrible societal collapse than they are right now. So I don't know that that's a great strategy and a solution. So I don't think that hiding from this is the best solution. But I also know that, like, I see this sort of similar comment from guys that pops up on my videos every once in a while, where guys will say, look, I see these things that you're talking about, and I tried to bring it to my church leaders or my institutional leaders or community leaders or whatever, and I was completely dismissed. Like, they started, and not just like dismissed, but they started blaming me and saying that I'm, you know, this bad person that's just being selfish, or they started saying that I'm just bitter and I hate women, or I'm lazy, and they're making all these assumptions about me, and they, you know, they sent me away and completely dismissed everything that I was bringing up about this. And so what I would say to guys, one of the things that is a consistent pattern every time I see that comment is that the guy went alone. He went by himself to the church leaders, to the community leaders, or whoever. And so it's very easy for, if you're like a pastor, your church elder, you're somebody in charge, it's very easy if all you ever see is one of these guys every few years that works up the courage to say something about this, and he comes by himself, it's super easy to just assume, well, yeah, this guy's an outlier. This isn't what I see most of the time. So, and I don't see anybody else who's speaking up about this. So obviously it's just not really a thing. So it's got to just be him. So it's very easy to dismiss guys when they go alone. And on top of that, like, you're not going to develop yourself as a person either by yourself. Even if there is that collapse, and even if there is a better thing on the other side of that, well, if you haven't spent those intervening years developing yourself and building yourself up and doing that together with other men, like iron sharpening iron, what are you going to have to be able to capitalize with on that, on the other side? So guys need to be getting together into groups, sharpening each other, making the best out of what God's given them, becoming the absolute best version of themselves that they possibly can be, and doing that together. And they need to be gathering up into groups and going to leadership and advocating for change within their current communities. The next thing for those guys to do is, yeah, if that doesn't work, if you know, you get together and you're maintaining yourself above reproach, like you're consistently repentant of your sin, you're not watching corn and OF girls all the time, and you're not, you know, being a lazy slob covered in Cheeto dust in your parents' basement and you know, drinking Mountain Dew all day and playing World of Warcraft or whatever the meme is. As long as you're like somewhat above reproach with those things, you're doing the best that you can with what God gave you. You don't have to be the top level man, but if you get a group of guys together who is doing the best they can and the girls are not reciprocating still, that is so much better evidence that you can show that, hey, no, this is a bunch of guys who are doing things the right way, and the right way is not being rewarded. And so, yeah, go together. Go to your church leaders, advocate for change. And if you do all of that stuff, you're above reproach, and you try your best, and you advocate for change, and you try to bring up these things, and it's still, even as a group, it still doesn't happen. They still, you know, there's still too much resistance, and you can't find a place that will deal with this stuff properly. Well, then it might be time to start new places. It might be good for guys to gather up together and say, you know what, there might be a need for new institutions. You know, we're already kind of seeing that with schools. Like you're seeing things like Jordan Peterson coming out with the Peterson Academy, because the education system has been so ideologically captured that it's just, a lot of it is, it's just too overrun to be able to take it back anytime soon. So they're coming out with alternatives and just saying, you know what, we're going to start a different school. And so there may be some need for guys at some point to just say, you know what, if church is going to be the same thing where it's completely overrun with feminism and teachings that are not scriptural, like women are not being held accountable to the standards set for them in scripture while the men are still, and you know, if you're still seeing those things, you're not seeing change on that, well, it might be time to build churches from the ground up that don't have any of that stuff, that are designed from day one to show no gender bias or favoritism towards one sex or the other in terms of the way the word of God is administered at a practical level. I mean, you don't have to like start new churches theologically. I'm not saying like, hey babe, wake up, new schism just dropped, but like you might have to. I'm definitely not saying like you would need to teach a different gospel or create a cult or anything like that. No, I'm just saying you don't need to teach different Christianity. You might need a different administration. And I think that that's going to happen at some point once a lot of these guys start to grow up and get into positions of leadership. And, you know, the older generations are sort of, they kind of filter their way out. I think that's going to happen eventually. I just think we need to make sure that we're doing this in a way that, one, we're not going so slow that we're leaving a lot of guys behind, and a lot of guys are getting so frustrated and fed up that they don't want to participate with any part of life. They don't want to participate with church or Christianity. And we lose a lot of guys' souls as a result of that. And, you know, you end up with a lot of guys killing themselves and all of that because they can't find a place to go where they can find any relief from being, you know, be the world that hates them and being sinned against by people, because nobody cares when anybody sins against a man. It's like, no, we need to make sure that we're not leaving those guys behind. But yeah, it might just come down to like, if we can't do that fast enough with, you know, changing our current institutions, we might have to just get guys together and start new ones. And that's actually something that we're looking to do over the other project that I'm trying to work on over on my channel is gather up a group of guys to start exactly that, just to start a brand new kind of church where we're just going to administer the word of God the way that it says to be administered. We're going to try to protect everyone from their own sin. And protect other people from other people's sin. Like, there's a saying in you know, the Christian community, in a number of churches I've been to, where they say, you are safe here, but your sin is not. Mm-hmm. Right? Because sin destroys everything it touches. And in order for people to be safe and to thrive, sin can't be safe in that place. So I genuinely believe that's true. I just don't believe right now that most churches actually administer that to both genders. And so, yeah, the goal is to create a church where, you know, we're bringing people to Jesus. We're worshiping the same God as everybody, you know, everybody else in the Christian community. And we're trying our best to serve him and love him and teach his word and teach his way. But we're going to administer this in a way that's just and right according to God's word. And we're not going to bow down to emotions and culture and what people feel is, or romanticism even. We're just going to try our best to follow God and protect our people from each other's sin and from their own sin, because that's what's best for men. And it's also what's best for women too. Like, it is not good for women to simply just let them rot in their own sin. That's terrible for their own souls and the quality of their own life, and the quality of their relationships. So yeah, I think those are kind of the three steps: is get guys together, get them working on themselves, get them advocating for change in their communities, and if need be, get them starting new communities and institutions and building new things.
I feel like I need to ask this. Mm-hmm. Looking at the, let's call us the big brothers, and just shine the light here for a second.
Yeah.
What do we need to be doing to help our younger boys out? Right? Because I don't want to let me off the hook. Because we talked earlier about, you know, it's like, oh, well, I got mine. What's wrong with you guys? Okay, well, recognizing that there's a problem, what do we need to be doing and how can we help?
That is a great question. And that was something that somebody commented on one of my videos, that they were like, when they found out that I was married, they were like, wow, actually, I appreciate this channel even more, because so much of the time, once a Christian guy gets married, like, guys will talk about these problems while they're single, but once they get married, a lot of times they do that exact thing. They're like, sweet, I got mine. And then they turn around and they leave, and they just don't pay any attention to it or put any effort into it anymore. And I think for us, as sort of the big brothers of the church, or of the you know, of our culture and our society, is we can't stay silent and just stick to ourselves. If we're doing kind of the same thing, where we're like, well, my mission is just, you know, raising my kids, you know, because that's kind of the cliche line that you'll hear a lot of Christian guys say, is like, well, that's the thing that God's given me to do, is just raise my kids and raise my family well, and I'm just focused on that, and I'm just gonna do my job and take care of my family, and that's it. Well, that doesn't really follow with what it says in, I think it's in 1 Peter, where he talks about, look not only to your own interests, but to the interests of others. And so, yeah, we have to make sure that us as big brothers, we're looking out for our, you know, we're looking out for the other guys. We don't just get tunnel vision on whatever we're doing for ourselves and, you know, and our own families. That we look up and expand our vision and recognize these things, but also just, we can't stay silent about it. Like, if these guys do start bringing these things forward, if it is really true that it is that bad, then once guys start bringing it forward to their church leaders, we need guys backing them up. And I'm already starting to see this happen at a number of churches, where these conversations are starting to happen. And even some of the married guys are getting involved, because they are starting to say, you know what, we're seeing this. We don't think this is healthy. We don't think this is right according to God's word. And they're starting to go to their pastors and elders and have conversations about it. And, you know, I'm watching guys on church staff sometimes even, who are starting to have conversations with other guys on their staff. And so, yeah, I think it starts with us just having the conversations about it, and being willing to be in these guys' corner when it's appropriate, when it's needed, when they do actually bring up something valid. Don't abandon them and just ignore it. Another thing is, yeah, just try to keep encouraging them and show them that, like, hey, this can get better, and we're going to work to make it better, and we'll work with you, we'll work alongside you, we'll help you to develop yourself and to become the best version of yourself possible. And we're going to work on making sure that the structures that you're working inside of are as much in alignment with God's word and God's ways we possibly can, so that you don't have to have this constant fear of, you know, what's gonna happen to you. The last thing I would say is, if the bad stuff does happen to those guys, let's say if they do get into that relationship or that marriage with, you know, the reviling wife, or they do go through that divorce, don't abandon them then either. Because that's another thing I see, is one of the reasons why these guys are afraid to go through those things is because they get so little support on the other side of it, that it's like they know the moment that it happens, they're going to be abandoned, that they won't have that community support anymore. I've watched this happen to a number of Christian guys who've been through divorces, where just nobody really cares about their side of it or what's going on with them, and people stop kind of reaching out to them anymore and stop supporting them and stop including them as a part of the community. And those guys don't really stay a part of any community much longer after that. They rarely stay Christian. It turns really bad really fast, because those guys are going through a lot. It really sucks to go through that kind of thing. So we need to show guys that, hey, if the worst happens, we will absolutely be there for you. We're going to do everything we can we can't take all the danger out of this. We can't make the danger level zero. But what we can do is provide every support that we can along the way to try to prevent things from getting that bad. We'll provide support for you, and you know, we're going to try our best, if, you know, your wife is being a reviling wife, to try to, as a community and as a church and as, you know, as a leadership, to hold her accountable for that. So we're going to try to counterbalance that threat. If she does divorce you and leave you, we're going to support you. We're not going to abandon you. We're going to continue to be there for you. And if you need help, whether it's, you know, financially or whatever it may be, we'll try to help as best we can. So show these guys that, yeah, the danger is not zero. We're working on it. We're trying to make it better, but we don't have that, you know, safe environment yet, but we're going to do everything that we can to sort of mitigate the dangers in as many ways as we can and support you, even if things do kind of go off the rails.
Yeah, that's good stuff. There's one other thing I want to ask you, but I just realized that I did the ugly thing tonight, and I made everything all about the dudes, which was exactly one of the problems that you said that we do.
Yeah.
So I would like to ask you this. Would you be willing to come back and have another sit-down conversation about the other side of what your channel deals with, and that's the ladies?
Yeah.
And what the church should do about that, because I would love to have a long conversation, same as we did, and unpack all of that, because that's a thing that almost nobody that I've heard outside of you and maybe like one other channel is talking about. And you mentioned several times tonight that they're not held accountable, and the church doesn't even hold them accountable, because it seems, like you said, it violates people's natural instincts. It violates, you know, what they feel are Christian principles and like all this other stuff. And I'd really like to unpack all of that with you, but I think that would probably be another 2-hour conversation. Oh, yeah. If we launched into it right now. So, Matt, I just want to say thank you so much for the conversation tonight. Like, I thought it was all good stuff. I learned a lot. And please let everybody know, like, where they can find you if they want to go be a part of what you're doing or go support you. Let them know.
Yeah, so most everything right now, I mean, first of all, thanks for having me on. It's been a great conversation. Yeah. I really appreciate giving me a chance to kind of talk through some of this stuff. And I think you're absolutely right. I think that it would take another 2-hour conversation to go through sort of the lady side of stuff. And yeah, because
I want to have it though.
Yeah, because I mean, yeah, we can't just keep putting everything on the guys. It's just they're getting exhausted with everything being on their shoulders. So yeah, we are gonna, it will be helpful to kind of look at what it is that we're missing and not doing right now, and what it is that we should start doing and how we might be able to implement that. As far as channel and where to find me, Effective Purpose is the YouTube channel. So yeah, you can head there. If you go to the channel pages, there's links to all kinds of other stuff. Like there's the Patreon and the Discord. We have a pretty good, pretty active Discord community. That yeah, once you're a Patreon member, you can get access to that, and yeah, it's pretty lively discussion, kind of all the time in there. A lot of guys supporting each other, praying for each other, and you know, sharing the lives with each other. It's been really good there. We're also starting up. We're starting that process of figuring out how to start brand new churches. And we're looking for guys who are interested in doing that. So if anybody listening to this sees that need and they feel like they have some skills that could be lent towards potentially, we're going to try to plant an online church first and see if we can get some geographical hotspots located and maybe start planting some IRL brick and mortar places. That's kind of how we're theorizing right now. But like, yeah, if that sounds to anybody listening, like that's something that they might want to contribute to, or that you know someone who would, you know, fit that kind of profile. Yeah, just head on over to Patreon, or send me a message there. Head on over to Discord. We're getting together a Discord channel where we're just going to focus on talking about that stuff and how to build those things. Yeah, that's most of where I am. I have social media pages and stuff that I don't really use for very much, but yeah, just head over to YouTube.
Well, that's awesome, and I can personally vouch for how active your Discord is. That's actually how I got in touch with you. Yeah. So pretty cool there. I have a question though. Is that a male only space?
It is
in your Discord. Okay, because I noticed like one of the very first things that happened when I dropped in there was somebody added somebody else and they were like, I think this is a chick, and then all of a sudden it blew up and I was like,
No, the only woman in the server right now is my wife, and that's because I don't have time to moderate it myself, so she took that role. And no, she's constantly looking out for the guys. She's kind of like mama bear in the server, trying to look out for them as best she can. But other than that, we want to make sure that it's a space that doesn't kind of get taken over and kind of captured. Cause once you have, like men need to have spaces that are just men. They just do, because any place where once women get in, it becomes a very different thing and it starts to play by very different rules and there's no way to stop that. So yeah, it is a place that if you're a guy that you're looking for just a men's only space, it's a great place to be with a bunch of really good dudes who are having a good time.
No girls allowed. I love it, dude. Yeah. Well, thank you so much. Thank you so much for being on tonight, man. I thoroughly enjoyed the conversation. Guys, as you know, make sure that you go down below. I am going to include the link for Effective Purposes YouTube channel in the description of this video. So if you guys want to hop over and check Matt out and what he's doing, it'll be right down there below. But also make sure that you check out the people that support us. Head on over to redpillthreads.com, buy a shirt, do all that other stuff. But his link will be right up top if you guys want to hop over and check Matt out. Thank you guys so much for hanging out with us tonight. Or I guess actually this one's going to air on a Saturday morning. So thank you for hanging out with us on a Saturday morning. Have an awesome rest of your day. Go with God and don't be a dick.